it becomes quite exciting after a bit doing meditation, because you're virtually doing spiritual sleuthing into your own past. And that is fascinating. There is nothing more fascinating than that. And then also discovering how closely you were involved with other people, some whom you may know and some whom you may never have dreamed you knew. I discovered there was a connection between this monk and myself, and two more unlikely people for a connection I couldn't have thought of. But it was there. You're not necessarily going to find many of them, one or two, but they exist.
Is the resolution in the discovery?
The resolution is in the discovery and the decision to say, okay, I was an ass.
Acknowledgement of what you...
I'm not going to do that again.
Yeah. See, there's always a relevancy. You don't get this information sort of randomly or for fun. There's always a relevancy of that to this life. There's always something to be learned from it. And there's always a tendency that you have at present, or a possibility of something at present, that could be a repetition of a past mistake, or the opposite of a past mistake, you know, going particularly the other side.
Frequently you just swing, I'm not going to make that, you make the decision at death, I'll never do this again, and you swing to exactly the opposite.
So there's always something very practical to be learned. Very, very practical.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, you become aware of whatever details of the past that you may become aware of, only those details that are of use.
You're not there to discover whether you were the Queen of Sheba or something of that sort. You're there to discover what sort of a mess you made. And you're not going to find out names and places and that sort of detail. You're going to see what you did, which was stupid.
Those kinds of details are usually irrelevant, names and places.
They're not important.
Sometimes you're talking about, but usually you don't. Doesn't matter.
You had a question, my friend.
Yes. I'm sure you're familiar with these near-death experiences that people have, tunnel and the light.
I've read some of them, yes.
And I just wonder what relationship that has to this... how you would fit that in with this...
It's extraordinarily similar. In fact, the full Kensho experience is virtually what I call a dry run for death. Forgive me for putting it that way, but it is a dry run. I have had three to date, and they follow the near-death experiences pretty exactly. But the more you have, the less scaring they are. Oh, this again, ah yes. And when the death comes, yes, you just change over and you keep it going again.
Could you describe you as is it as similar as I've heard it mostly from Christians, so I just wonder, I've always wondered if a Buddhistic thinking would be the same.
The Buddhist comes out to the, well, they're exactly the same in this sense. The cosmic Buddha is pure love. Therefore, she, I don't know, call it what, X, Y, Z, whatever, will appear, since it is pure love, will appear in any form that you think of it in. As I understand it, because you know the old saying, no man may see God and live. So he, she, it appears in, through a screen, shall we say. Maybe it is the screen of Christ, maybe it is the screen of Shakyamuni Buddha, which is how it appeared to me, which is how it came to me. And there is a very interesting thing, which I'm sure you know of, in Dr. Moody's book of The Atheist. And it appeared as this lovely warm cloud. And afterwards he's being questioned, well, I mean, were you hallucinating? And he slams his fist down and says, damn it, I am a psychiatrist and I know when somebody's hallucinating. And I was not. One of the things, I remember seeing him on TV and I loved that for that comment. Because that's exactly it. He had not got any screen to see it through, and the exquisite love that would say, all right, I'll just come to you as a warm, comfortable cloud of love. And he said it was like being in a womb, an exquisitely warm mother's womb, but it was more than a mother's womb. It was a mother's womb, a father's womb. It was the whole womb of love. Fine, he's described it perfectly. It'll come to you in whatever way is best for you, or however you have thought of it. Now, if you judge yourself at the moment of death and there is doubt, then that is what you're going to get. If you judge, if there is fear at the moment of death, that is what you're going to get. But you've got all that cleared out of the way. In other words, if you've found suffering's cause, if you've got to the head of your corn, then what is there to separate you? Now that you see it in one form or another is neither here nor there.
Something I think we'll probably be going into in much more detail
yes.
in the next couple of days is
yes.
that experience in detail
yes.
From the Buddhist point of view. And,
because really what the purpose of meditation is to give you a bunch of dry runs so that you're so used to it that when it happens it's just like having another meal or another sit down to meditation and here we go again. And there's absolutely no fear and no terror. It's an exquisite thing.
Which, of course, also gets you to the other purpose of meditation, which is that you're not afraid of living.
Oh, brother, can you live when that happens?
You're not afraid of dying.
And a dimension of life opens that you never saw before. Instead of seeing, shall we say, Oakland and Berkeley as this murky, mucky place where somebody is likely to mug you any minute, you begin to realize that this is a darn beautiful place to live in. Yeah, so somebody's an ass now and then. But he's got the Buddha nature.
So our mountain could blow up any time, you know?
Oh, we're living on the side of a volcano over here. I don't think it's going up for 400 years. They don't expect it to, but nobody expected Vesuvius to go up. That hadn't been up for 1,000. Live without fear, because if it happens, you've done all your dry runs. Yes?
I want to talk about the subject of suicide. Don't you think there are some extreme circumstances that allow for suicide? I give an example, for example, torture in concentration camps. The circumstances are that hard that you maybe lose your integrity in that when you lose that, life is not worthwhile, and you decide because of your integrity.
The only answer I can give you is this. I cannot see any means by which I would ever, under any circumstances, commit suicide. Nor would I ever advocate it to anyone. But I am not in a concentration camp. If I were in there and I were being tortured, I have no knowledge of what I would do. I know what I think I would do. I say the same thing to people who say that they are non-violent, that they are conscientious objectors to war and the like. I went through World War II. My father died during it, and I was a teenager during that time. It is very easy to say, I do not believe in violence, I will not kill. I am a non-violent person, but there were a few times when I wouldn't have minded a bomb to sling at Hitler. And I have to recognize that that exists within me, and not pretend that it doesn't. It does not matter that it exists within me, so long as I know it's there. I'm not likely to sling the bomb if I know I have the potential possibility or the capability of doing it. The person who is dangerous is the person who believes he's got beyond all that, who believes he is not human, in other words, to have such human feelings. The answer to your question is, if I were in that situation, I cannot answer you. I don't know. I'm not in it.
Thank you.
It's the best answer I can give you, and it's the only honest one I can give you.
Well, my opinion is, are there other circumstances that
I cannot say. I cannot advocate it, and I won't. Fair enough. The present day and age, people think of a koan as something in some strange enigmatic story or situation that a Zen master either tells to his disciple or in which he places him. The basis of all koans, however, is of course the Four Noble Truths. Everybody is aware of the first stage of the koan. Suffering exists, which is the first of the Four Noble Truths. Everybody knows that suffering exists. We all put up with it to a certain extent at some time or other. And even when we're in our happiest moods, we know that it's going to pass and some suffering is going to turn up sooner or later. So in that sense, even the happiness is suffering. Yes, unfortunately. Right. The first stage of the koan is suffering exists. And it is this stage that brings a person to try to understand what the koan is. The second stage of the koan, suffering's cause, is what you find out as a result of meditation, the cause of your suffering, where it starts from, how and why. It is fairly easy to see the cause of suffering in this life, because it would seem reasonable that you would know what has happened in this life. But even with the fact of our own childhoods to consider in this respect, it's very difficult to remember all the things that happened, because the memory is very selective. Therefore, we frequently have the effects of things that we do or have done, and we don't know the causes of them. I have told people on a number of occasions, and if anyone here has heard this story, I must ask their indulgence. I have told a story about myself. I had for many, many years an allergy to any form of rubber. I could not bear an eraser near me without throwing up. And as a result of meditation, I discovered that when I was about 3 months old, I was being operated on in a hospital. Somebody had put a mask, a rubber mask, over my face. The smell of rubber associated itself with asphyxiation. Therefore, any time anybody got a rubber near me, I proceeded to throw up just to make sure that nobody asphyxiated me. It was a very simple thing. Once I had discovered what was the cause, i.e., when I had discovered suffering's cause, the illness or the allergy or whatever they like to call it ceased. And now it doesn't matter to hoots what. Anyone can bring rubber near me, I understand the meanings of it. So this is one example of, in this life, how you find suffering's cause through meditation. Allergies, all sorts of stray ailments, aches and pains, that people go to the doctor with, and the doctor scratches his head and says, well, I can't find anything wrong, but why don't you have some Valium or something of the sort and you'll feel better. If the person meditated on it, he might find something very, very different. He might find suffering's cause, quite literally. And this is one of the great values of meditation. When the doctor can't find something wrong, and believe me, you should always check with the doctor to see if his anything is genuinely physically wrong. If the doctor can't find anything wrong, try meditation. The odds are that something is affecting you from way back when, which can be dealt with rather than by going to see a psychiatrist or a psychologist, which can be dealt with by yourself and forgive me for putting it this way, at a lot more cheaply, with a lot less misery. We have found many such things have had that result. Just go see the doctor. If nothing can be proved or found, then start to meditate on it. I had another one. For many years I had not been able to run. Well, ever since I could remember, going back in meditation, I discovered that there had been an injury to my left leg. When I had dealt with that and looked at it and dealt with the situation, I can now move it completely normally. All that was left there was a sort of memory, what in Buddhism is called a skandhic memory. And if the doctor can't find the cause, then meditation very probably will. So, finding of suffering's cause, the second stage of the koan. The third stage of the koan is the cessation of suffering, or the third noble truth. How do you cease from suffering? Obviously, it is first to recognize what was the cause, and then to make sure you don't do it again. In my own case, of the story I told you, obviously, it is not going to happen again, because if someone were to try and give me an anesthetic now, I would know what they were doing. So that one is very neatly removed completely. But there are many others that are not. I'm sure you've all heard of the athlete who is constantly pulling the same muscle. And in the end, he may actually have to give up the athletic, the particular exercise, in order not to damage the muscle anymore. That is a radical method. But sometimes, in order to get to the third stage of the koan, the cessation of suffering, it is necessary to give up the activities that caused the suffering. We have many of these on a very low level, obvious ones of these on a very low level in the world at the present time. Someone will give up beating his wife if he does not get drunk. Therefore, if he gives up the drink, the wife will not get beaten. That's putting it on its lowest level. But there are many, many other things on much more subtle levels. If you give up such and such, then there will not be suffering. If you give up exaggerating when you are talking to other people, then you will not be worried about what is going to happen next time you talk to them. And better still, you do not have to remember what you said to everybody, which can be a very considerable source of worry. So, suffering's cause and the cessation of suffering. I am going to have to go back to this because it ties in with two of the others very deeply. The fourth one is the Eightfold Path, which teaches us how to prevent a repeat of the suffering. And it is simply eight steps. Right mindfulness leads to right thinking. Right thinking leads to right speech. Right speech leads to right action. Right action leads to right livelihood. Right livelihood leads to right effort. Right effort leads to right mindfulness, and right mindfulness to right meditation. So you've got the eight steps of the path, or if you get one right, you'll get the next right. It is as if each one is the parent of the next. If you think right, you'll speak right. If you speak right, you'll do right. If you do right, you'll work right. If you work right, you'll make enough effort, and if you make enough effort, then you've got your mind in the right place. And therefore, you find yourself in on the center of meditation. The way in which to keep suffering from coming back. The Four Noble Truths that the Buddha himself spoke are, in fact, a blueprint for every koan. Any koan you go through, you will find has these four stages.
I do not intend to go into koans because that is not the purpose of these lectures. But I do have to go into this because if you are going to find out how to live completely free from fear of death, then you have got to find the cause of the fear. And in finding the cause of the fear, you will find how to deal with the fear. And in finding how to deal with the fear, you will find how to get onto this beautiful system known as the Eightfold Path. Now, frequently Buddhists, or people, Western people, who have studied Buddhism, think that that is all there is to it. And in one respect, they're completely right. Except that there is what can best be described as a higher law, which is the fundamental cause of all the theories and beliefs. And these are known as the five laws of the universe. They're very, very interesting self-evident laws, and they do not, again, conflict with any religious teaching. The first one is, nothing whatsoever in the universe is answerable to my personal will. In other words, I am not God. A very important first law to keep in mind. I am not God. A lot of people in this present day and age think that a Zen master, as I said yesterday, or any teacher, is a sort of God in his or her own right to be followed. Have got the first law of the universe right. Nothing is answerable to my personal will. And they make it very clear that that is the teachings of the Buddhas and patriarchs. So, the first law of the universe, nothing is answerable to my personal will. The second law is that all things change. The original form of that was everything is in a state of flux. The reason for that was because of the liquidity that I spoke of yesterday of the cosmic Buddha. Because that which is true, that which is permanent, is always flowing, or fluctuating, or moving, or undulating within every living, within every animate and inanimate thing, rather than every living thing. Since that is constantly there, everything is aging, everything becomes young, everything becomes old, because of the constant change, and because that which is the cosmic Buddha is as a constant flow, the original form of the second law of the universe was all things are in a state of flux. Then changed to all things flow. And then because both the words flux and flow either didn't get explained accurately or because people didn't completely understand them, it became all things change. They all grow old, decay, and die, and are reborn. The whole world is cyclic. The whole universe is cyclic. That is the second law. The third is karma. It is inexorable and inevitable. If you do something, you will reap the consequences of that action. I am not here speaking in terms of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Nothing so obvious as that. On its lowest level, if you kick a dog, it will bite you. On its highest level, if you worry, you will mess up your stomach. In other words, if you get angry, you will damage your liver. If you get frustrated, you will damage your gallbladder. If you feel insecure, you may very possibly get diabetes. Buddhism has found a very definite correlation from with all the emotions to each one of the organs. And that is, we are bringing out fairly soon, Dai Zui and I, in a book called The Book of Life. So all of that will be clearly in print for people to make use of. Buddhism has known this for centuries, and in the end, this is the real meaning of karma. It also puts paid to so-called morality, which has upset so many people for so many centuries. If you kill the person, one person may lose his physical life, but the person who really gets hurt is the murderer, for he destroys his own soul. If you steal, somebody loses some physical thing, but when you truly understand karma, the person who really loses is the thief, because he loses his peace of mind. And so it continues. I am hoping that we can go into this very, very much more, but I want to skim our 5 points quickly before we get into the discussion of them. Karma is not so simple a thing as cause and effect, as most people think about it. It is a very, very much deeper thing than this. And it can only really be explained clearly by giving you examples from people who have had it happen to them, and who, as a result of their studies, can show you what did happen to them in both present and past lives. Now, thank you. Past and future lives. The reason for past and future lives must be clearly understood. It is not so that you can find out who you were. It is so that you can find out the mistakes that you made and rectify them. In other words, you get past lives come up for yourself. When you have more or less cleaned up most of this life, there's not much left, but there is still something that has not been dealt with. And then you will go back in time, quite naturally, without any help from somebody else, to find out what was suffering's cause then. You will see what you did, you will see how it ties in with the tendency now. And if you wish to get into the prevention of suffering, i.e. the cessation of suffering, then you are going to have to look at how it came up in that previous life and make sure it doesn't come up again in this one. And that is exactly the purpose for seeing past lives, to make sure you don't make the same mistake, i.e. the cessation of suffering. And maybe you will get two or three lives in which you did almost identically the same thing in totally different situations back down the line. And then you may get what is also called a future life. You may quite possibly see how you will probably die in this life. This is not so that you can think, right, I am going to die in such and such a way. It is so that you can see, I have such and such a tendency, so I should make sure that I am prepared for when this type of illness hits, so that I can live as long as possible and do as much good as I can. Past life is given you for the same reason as future life, not to make mistakes. For example, I happen to know that I am going to die of bronchitis. Well, that's fine. Any time I have any sign of that coming up, I ring up the doctor. I do not wait and say, right, this is the time, tomorrow I will kick the bucket. I get the information fast, tell the doctor, and have the necessary stuff ready to make sure that I am better. In other words, you make use of this to prevent suffering, and so that you personally can do as much good as you possibly can in this world. Do you understand the purpose of past lives? Not to find out that you were Napoleon or something equally stupid, but to find out that you were Joe Bloggs, who made an awful lot of mistakes, and that in this present life, you, Joe Bloggs of today, is making mistakes, and that that's not very sensible, and that they can be avoided. The purpose of past and future lives. Now, supposing you have cleaned up all these areas, supposing they are all cleaned up, and you have got to the state when you don't worry about what's going to happen tomorrow because it doesn't matter. You're all nicely cleaned up and ready. If somebody accidentally kills you on the freeway, that's fine. You are going to go straight to the cosmic Buddha because you know you are one with him and you are permanently with him. Therefore, there is no fear of death. And when this bunch of skandhas departs, there is no problem. And this is called training for training's sake. People have often said to me, well, when you've done all this, why do you keep on keeping the precepts and why do you keep on doing this? The answer is because I don't want to produce any more of the stuff that is going to separate me from the cosmic Buddha. And this is known as training for training's sake, just keeping going, doing that which has to be done, because that's the right way to do it. Now, I've covered a tremendous amount. I don't want to cover any more unless we have questions and answers, so that we're ready for the debate. Anybody got anything? Yes, go ahead.
Does one deliberately set out to meditate in order to see past lives? Or
no.
Is this something that occurs in the long
Not necessarily. It can happen at any time, and frequently people have them happen when they haven't had any, when they haven't done any meditation at all. Children frequently have it happen. And parents get worried about it because they think that the child is imagining things or making tales up, which is rather sad, when in fact the child is merely seeing something, simply because it is closer to the time when it made the changeover. No, you do not set out deliberately to see past lives. If they come, they come. Some people never seem to have anything come up at all. Maybe they just aren't ready for it, maybe they aren't meditating deeply enough, or better still, maybe they cleaned it all up last time round. You can't answer that. You can't look at somebody and say, well, since nothing came up, you're obviously doing it wrong. You very possibly may not be doing it wrong. Anybody else got something? Yeah.
It seems to me that the part about the suffering in life is also compatible with an acceptance of the suffering of life, that there's not a separate thing.
Oh, no. But the importance of doing it in the Buddhist way is that you don't accept it, what's the word, not with despair.
Resignation.
With resignation. You accept it joyfully because you can handle it, rather than with resignation, which brings despair and a worse state than you were in before. It's being able to accept what happens joyfully. In other words, it's I have occasionally thought that if everybody studied Buddhism properly, it would be rather sad for psychiatrists and psychologists. They'd all be out of work. My apologies to any who happen to be present, but that is true. Yes, go ahead.
Are there any meditations that incorporate laughing?
I can tell you this, that when someone has a kensho, or when they first start having a kensho, they are quite likely to laugh or cry. I don't know how many of you have read the book Kundalini, Psychosis or Transcendence. Have any of you read that by Dr. Sanella? He is a psychiatrist who discovered that maybe some of his patients were not suffering from mental illness, but were instead
having some sort of religious experience. And he wrote a very, very excellent little book on it. We've got it up in the bookshop. And the thing that is fascinating in it is that he has discovered what goes on in actual Zen temples, because when someone has a religious experience, it does look, in the very early stages, like a psychotic break. The person can laugh and can cry. Their emotions seem to be all out of whack, all inappropriate. But there's something there that you know does not make the person ill. There's a quiet peace underneath it all, a quiet joy. It's a really very, very beautiful thing. Yes, he's crying his eyes out on the floor and he's looking at you and saying, don't worry about me, I'm terrific. And you think, well, I ought to comfort this person, but I don't need to comfort him. He doesn't want me to. He's doing fine. And he's still crying his eyes out, and you're not quite sure why. Or he may be laughing like mad on the sofa, because of how stupid he's been. Not to have understood it. The Chinese are rather interesting on this one. Because when it comes to Zhou Kai, which is the time of officially becoming a Buddhist, the Chinese priest will say to him, now, what do you do for a living? I see you are a merchant. Does that mean you would like not to take the precept against stealing? It's quite literally said. I think it's much more honest than we are. They say to the person, now look at yourself. Are you willing to give up the job you are doing? Are you a completely honest merchant? And if not, only take those precepts you genuinely mean to keep. I frankly like the honesty of it. To our minds it looks odd, but it's not. The person is not deceiving himself, and the priests aren't being deceived either. I have known people in the East go to the priest and say, well, I'm young. I really can't stop getting into bed with girls, so I really want to be a Buddhist, though. Can I take the other precepts and take that one later? And they'll let him. It's an acceptance of a situation that is going to be repaired with time, which I find very beautiful and very honest. It's not saying, oh, you've got to give it all up right now, you're a bad young man, you're wicked, you're... It's not putting a guilt trip on him. It's saying how much you're prepared to do right now. And we'll do the next bit next year, or maybe the year after when you are ready. And recognizing that you're going to carry the consequences, i.e. the karma, for not dealing with that one right now. All right, if you're willing to carry the karma for it, that's fine. Do as much as you can do. Yes.
There was something that you wonder about, and that's the idea of the individual self continuing, you know, life after life, the same self. You know,
it's not the same self.
And that bothered me.
It's not the same self. It's not the same self. It's... Oh, dear, I explained this. I've gone into this in a colossal chapter in the Book of Life. I give you this accurate. Well, we are a mixture, but the thing is this. A person dies, all right? Now, he has converted a large part of himself. A large part of himself, therefore, will return to the cosmic Buddha, as it were, to the clean pool, to the pure pool. That which is not converted, supposing there is unconverted sex, that will join up with other pieces of unconverted sex and go to somebody else. And that person is going to have a colossal koan of unconverted sex. So if somebody dies with a large amount of unconverted sex, guess what? He gets a lump more to handle next time round. Somebody else dies with a large lump of unconverted stealing. He will collect up bits and pieces from other people of unconverted stealing, so that he's got a critical mass. And that is how